Welcome back. Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer?
Father, I pray for your serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to make the difference.
Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker. It's Victor from San Marcos.
Hi, my name is Victor, and I'm an alcoholic.
Victor.
I'd like to introduce the speaker, Chris. No, I'm just kidding. Chris has actually heard me speak quite a few times. You probably could tell my story. Mike, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. Let's see. I'd like to start off by saying I went to this meeting a few months ago, and this woman had mentioned that she had a plan. And it got me thinking when I was sitting in the meeting, because I remember when I had a plan before I started drinking. And I could tell you, not once did that plan ever include me becoming an alcoholic. And not once did that plan include me becoming the biggest embarrassment for my family. It didn't include me dropping out of college, and I did that so well, I did that twice. And it didn't include me becoming that guy that you'd see on the subway floor in New York, rolling around in the filth that was just too drunk to get up. But that's where drinking took me, and it took me there pretty fast. But I want to say it wasn't always like that. I grew up in Brooklyn, if you guys haven't figured that one out yet. And I think I'm losing my accent, but people tell me I'm not. I grew up in Brooklyn. It was basically a blue-collar neighborhood, and you know, everybody worked hard, and my parents worked hard, and they were always accountable. I had one older sibling, an older sister by 5 years. And my parents sent us both to Catholic school, Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school. And there wasn't any beatings in the house, and there wasn't any yelling and screaming, and there wasn't any drinking in the house. And, you know, as far back as I can remember, I had lots of friends, and I always felt comfortable in that circle of friends. But once you got me out of that circle, I didn't feel comfortable. And I was probably the kind of kid that could have used a drink in kindergarten, but I just didn't have it available to me. And, you know, it seemed like I was the kind of kid that was always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I don't know where that came from. And I'd say the most outstanding characteristic I had was I was always afraid. I was afraid of everything. And like I said, I went to Catholic school, and I can tell you that never helped anything in the fear department. You know, and I could remember the specific lessons that were taught by the brothers. And one of the lessons was from Brother Gilbert. And we all came into class one day, all us little boys in our uniforms and ties, and sat down. And Brother Gilbert was up there at the chalkboard with the chalk in his hand. He said, "Today we're going to learn about mortal and venial sins." And he wrote mortal sins on the board and venial sins and drew a line down the middle of them. And he started listing some mortal sins. And he said, "These mortal sins, if you do mortal sins, you're going to go straight to hell when you die." And I remember sitting there like a little startled, like, okay. And then he started listing some venial sins. And he said, enough venial sins add up to a mortal sin. And if you do enough of those, when you die, you'll go to hell. And then he turned around, he wrote something else on the board. And he said, "That? If you do that, you're going to go blind." And I remember I was already a little concerned because I was wearing glasses already, you know. And I looked up at the blackboard and it was still in focus, so I felt okay there. But I remember leaving the classroom thinking, geez, I can't believe, I'm a sinner and I'm going to go blind, you know. And we had other lessons taught to us by the brothers. And, you know, I had Brother John, and I remember one day, you know, he was talking to all us little boys, and he was telling us about when good people die, they go to heaven. And when they're in heaven, they can keep an eye on you and they can watch over you. And I took it as, oh my God, I've got all these eyes looking at me as I'm going blind. I can't believe this. And then another lesson I was taught was was God is everywhere. And, you know, He watches over you. And I didn't take it as God is everywhere. I took it as God is watching you. You know, and I kept these mortal and venial sins in the back of my mind all the time. You know, thinking if I'm going to go to heaven or not. And that was life in grammar school. And, you know, I won't get into the hell, purgatory, heaven lessons. Those were just some other lessons. But I went to Catholic high school also. And things did not get any better for me in high school. And my freshman year in high school, I decided I was going to run track. And I don't know where that came from, because that was outside of my little circle. And I ran track, and our track meets would be on Saturdays, and I would start throwing up on Thursdays. My nerves would just always, always get the best of me. And I would always be filled with anxiety. And basically that anxiety was, I was always concerned about how was I going to do and what were you going to think of me. I was always concerned about what you were going to think of me. And basically that was my whole freshman year, throwing up Thursday, Friday, track meet on Saturday. Then came my sophomore year. And my sophomore year, I figured I couldn't run track this year, so I decided to wrestle. And I don't know where that thought came from. And, you know, I wrestled 112 pounds. And I attribute being able to make weight really easily because I was always throwing up my freshman year and now my sophomore year. And the same pattern was repeated. You know, I would start throwing up 2 days before our tournaments, and, you know, I couldn't take it. I just couldn't take it. And I remember halfway through the season, I went to the coach and I told him, you know, I need to get off the team. And I lied to him. I said, my grades are low. My mother wants me off the team. And I gave him my uniform and I walked away. And I remember feeling that sense of relief. Like, you know, no one is expecting anything from me and I can go back to my little comfortable circle. And I still haven't taken a drink yet. And then came my junior year, and this is the year that that I took my first drink. And just to give you a little perspective of what it was like back then, Saturday Night Fever came out, and Rocky had come out the year before that. And you basically had everybody running around Brooklyn like a combo of the two. They would have their DA haircuts and their rope chains and wanting to fight. And that was pretty much the flavor of Brooklyn back then. And I had different groups of friends, but the friends that I would hang out with on the weekends were the guys that would drink. And the guys that would drink would do nothing but drink. And my other friends would go into the disco and trying to pick up girls, and, you know, other friends were going to the disco Roller Palace, which was big back then. And you know, they were doing these social things and around other people and trying to pick up girls. And I just did not feel comfortable with them. So I would hang out with the guys that would drink. And I felt comfortable with them. And what I would do is I would just have a soda and I would walk around and, you know, tag along with them. And I was always curious why they drank so much. I remember I would ask that question all the time, and the answer I would always get is, because it's fun. It's fun. I couldn't understand where the fun was, because these guys were basically throwing up on themselves and peeing on every other tree and falling off the curbs and falling into bushes, and I just didn't get the fun. And this one evening I was hanging out with them, and I remember my buddy Satch, and every good Brooklyn story has somebody named Satch in it. My friend Satch asked me if I wanted a beer, and they had asked me this countless other times. But for some reason I said yes. And I remember I took that beer from him and I cracked it open and it made the sound. Psst. I thought that was pretty cool right off the bat. And I started drinking this beer. And as I'm drinking it, I have two thoughts running through my mind. And the first thought is, this tastes so nasty. And my second thought was, but I think I need another one. And I didn't realize that when I took that first beer, that I was setting up this whole chain of events that was going to change my whole life. And I didn't realize by drinking that first beer that I was soon going to become, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally bankrupt, like it talks about in our literature. And I didn't realize that by drinking that first beer, all my relationships were going to change with family and friends and teachers and aunts, uncles, anybody that came in contact with me, my relationships were going to change. And I got to tell you, that night I ended up throwing up on myself. And I remember peeing on every other tree and falling into bushes and tripping over curbs. And I thought to myself, oh my God, these guys are so right. This is so much fun. This is just fun. And for the first time in my life, my insides ever matched my outsides. And for the first time in my life, I was comfortable in my own skin. And, I heard it described one time, I felt like a chameleon on a plaid blanket. And that's the way I had always felt prior to this night. And, basically I continued on being a weekend drinker with my friends, and then came my senior year in high school. And my senior year, I started to have more added pressures, because family members were actually expecting things from me, and they were asking me, what college do you want to go to, and, what kind of profession might you want, and what do you want to study? And all I kept hearing was, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And I didn't have any answers. I didn't have an answer. And I remember telling them finally I wanted to become an architect. And I soon learned that if you gave somebody an answer, they would leave you alone, especially if you gave them an answer they wanted to hear. So I gave them this answer. And my senior year, my drinking shifted. And where I was a weekend drinker, I now became pretty much a daily drinker. And that was, back in the time when the drinking age was 18. And if you were 16 and looked 18, you could easily drink in a bar without any questions asked. And I started daily drinking. And I also started to notice now that I was starting to get that obsession and that compulsion about alcohol. And for those of you that aren't quite sure, or newcomers, what an obsession is, and I've got a friend that uses his own definition. I never did find this in the dictionary, but he calls an obsession one thought that blocks out all other thoughts. And that's where I was. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about when is my next drink going to come? Where is my next drink going to be at? When am I going to get it? When can I start? And I always seem to have those thoughts on my mind. And then I finally got out of high school and I went to college, college interfered with my drinking a lot. There was a lot of work that was required from you. And I remember muddling through my first year in college and not really doing very well and not really caring, because all I really wanted to do was drink. I found something that actually seemed to fill the void I had. And I drank my whole freshman year, and at the end of that year, I decided I need to change colleges, because now the college was the problem. And I never could see where I was the problem. And I was also starting to notice with my drinking that I was starting to have to change my goals to meet my behavior. And I was starting to have to change things that I actually did want to do and change that. So I went to another college, and basically I took the same victor there and I got the same results. And I ended up, making it out of that college and not doing very well. But when I was going to school, I was working part-time as a messenger in Manhattan for this law firm. So after 2 years of college, I finally quit college. I started working as a messenger full-time in Manhattan. And, I remember seeing that disappointed look on my parents' face all the time. And I hated seeing that look. I just hated it. And I remember I was starting to get resentful towards my parents, and they were starting to become the problem. And what was happening, though, was my parents were judging me on my actions, and I really wanted them to judge me on my intentions. And the world started judging me on my actions, and I wanted everyone to start judging me on my intentions, but it just wasn't happening that way. And like I said, I worked 2 years in Manhattan, and my drinking is getting more out of control. You know, my parents don't quite know what to do with me. And one night I came home drunk, and I was so drunk I went into my parents' bedroom thinking it was mine. And I ended up pulling the end of the sheets up where they were sleeping, and I crawled in between them. And I started punching on their legs and their ankles and their feet. And, you know, they're yelling like, "Victor, what are you possibly doing?" And I remember I jumped out of the bed and I'm tucking the sheets back in. And as I'm walking away, I told them I was only kidding. And as I'm heading into my bedroom, I'm thinking to myself, that is going to be so hard to explain in the morning. And another time I left a friend's house. I was drinking pretty heavily at his house and it was pouring, raining out. And I ended up leaving and falling off the curb outside the front of his house. And it was a puddle that was about 3 or 4 inches deep. And I went face first in that puddle and I started drowning in that puddle. And I could not get out of that puddle. And he actually saw me from his living room and came running out and had to save me from this 3-inch puddle. And this is just kind of, you know, where my drinking was starting to take me. And what was scary was that my alcoholic life was starting to become a normal life to me. You know, and all these behaviors and all these crazy actions I was taking, just it didn't seem that bizarre for me. It just kind of seemed like par for the course. Like, this is what happens when you drink like I do. And, you know, like I said, I went back to school, went back to electronics school and got out of there and finally moved out of my parents' house. And with moving out of my parents' house, I moved in with a childhood friend that I went to grammar school and high school with and college and I had known for quite some time. And when I graduated electronics school, they had job placement, and I got a job in the telecommunications field. And that's the field I've been working at ever since. But I was living in Brooklyn and working in Manhattan. And I have to tell you, this was not easy to go from Brooklyn to Manhattan for me. A lot of times we would go out drinking after work. And, you know, sometimes I would spend 6 to 8 hours getting home. I would just be passed out on the trains and just... like I said, you know, I'd be rolling around on the floor, and I would try, you know, I figure if I read a newspaper and drink some beer on the way home, you know, I couldn't possibly fall asleep, and I would just end up falling asleep on the floor with beer poured all over me and newspaper stuck to me, and you know, as the train went and stopped, I would just be rolling up and down the aisle, and people would just be lifting up their feet to let me go by. And my drinking actually escalated when I was with Joe, and we were two peas in a pod, and we drank hard. And I was never arrested, and I can tell you it was not from lack of trying. Because there was one time Joe and I, we were racing our cars, and the cop stopped us. And I remember the cop got out of his car, and he'd asked us, like, what are you guys doing? And I explained to him, because now I was starting to not care for authority too much. And I remember explaining to him like he was the idiot, you know. And I was explaining to him how we were racing our cars. And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, but your car was on the sidewalk." And I remember telling him and explaining to him, but there wasn't enough room in the street for both our cars. So that's why I had to race mine on the sidewalk. And all he said to us was, "Go home." And I used to get that regularly, just go home. You know, another time I got stopped by the cops and they asked me if I was drinking, and I had a quart of beer, and I remember I stuck it between the door and the seat. And for some reason, you know, when I was stopped, of course I told him no, I wasn't drinking. And he opened up the car door. And that quart tipped over and started pouring out on his boots. And once again, it was just, you know, just go home. Okay. And I would go home. And this other time, and this one I really can't believe I wasn't arrested for. I was walking down Flatbush Avenue with my friends, and I see a cop car in the McDonald's parking lot, and I see the cops having their happy meals in McDonald's, and I see the cop in the parking lot, and the cop car in the parking lot. And I left my friends, and I started jumping on the hood and trunk of their car. I was thinking this was going to be a good idea to cave in their car. And I remember these cops came out who didn't look too happy after their Happy Meals, and they had their billy clubs in hand. And this one cop just swatted me off the car like I was a fly, and he cut open my face, and I'm lying there bleeding, and these cops just beat me with those nightsticks. And all they did was get in their car and drive off. And once again, my friends were, you know, picking up the tattered pieces of me and bringing me on home. And it was starting to get to the stage of my drinking where if you were one of my friends, you were kind of a permanent caregiver of me because, you know, anything could happen when we went out. Like I said, I was living in this house and working in Manhattan. I was living with my friend Joe, and the insanity was just really off the charts. And I want to share this one story in particular with you because it didn't have much meaning to me back then, but it sure has a lot of meaning to me now. And this one time, I leave work, and I start drinking with the guys after work, and I try to make it home. You know, and again, I'm riding the trains all night long. And I get off this one train, and I figured I'm in the South Bronx. And in order to, I needed to go in the other direction. In order to get in the other direction, I needed to actually go downstairs and cross the street and catch the train going in the other direction. And as I'm crossing the street, there are these five guys across the street and about halfway down the block, and they're yelling, "There's a white guy, let's kill him." And these 10 guys start charging me. So now, this car, out of nowhere, just pulls up in front of me. And it was this tatted couple in there, and they said, "Listen, you need to get in the car with us because they're serious. They're gonna kill you." So I see these 15 guys charging me. This is how I know if anyone's awake or asleep, okay? That's my test. You guys are asleep. So these guys are charging me, and they're getting closer, and I jump in that vehicle with these people, and bottles are being thrown, and everything's being thrown at the car. And these people were actually nice enough to drive me all the way home to my front door in Brooklyn. And I remember I said thank you, gave them my last $20, went in the house, of course, thinking nothing of it again. And the next day, I told my roommate Joe this story. And the only thing Joe said to me was, "Boy, aren't you lucky?" And that's what life was to me back then. It was either good luck or bad luck. That's all I was ever having, good luck or bad luck. And Joe, after we lived together for about 2.5 years, he went on and got married, and that left me living on my own, and I got a little studio apartment. And, you know, when I moved into the studio apartment, I didn't have him around all the time, but I still had my group of friends. But I noticed there was a little shift in my thinking. And this is where I started to do a little controlled drinking. And some of the things I used to do is just kind of like mark the bottle. And, you know, I'd tell myself, okay, once I hit that line, I'm going to go to bed. Do you think it ever worked once? No, it never did. Then another experiment I used to do was I would tell myself I'm only going to drink during commercials when I'm watching TV. So I'd watch my show and I'd be sitting there and commercials would come and I'd, great, you know, I'd pour myself a couple of shots and I would drink them and then the show would come back on. And you know what I did? I changed the channel. I kept looking for commercials. I'm like, there's got to be more commercials on TV. So needless to say, that was another failed experiment. And I was starting to do things like I would, you know, drunk dial girlfriends at night, and I thought I was slick. Like I'd have a pad by the phone, and I would try to take notes of our conversations, and you know, I'd be there like, "What did you call me?" You know, and because I didn't get it the first time, and I'd have to try to write it down, and every morning without fail, I would wake up, and I could never, ever, ever make heads or tails out of that chicken scratch. And also, this was the time of my drinking where I was starting to line up shot glasses in the refrigerator. And what I would do was, when I had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, after I went to the bathroom, I would swing by the refrigerator, take another shot or two, and then I'd go back to bed. And I would do that because I would never want my brain to turn on. When it turned on in the middle of the night, it was kind of like I had a radio, a TV, and like three people talking all at once up there. And no matter how drunk I was, I would never get back to sleep if that turned on. And I was always afraid of it turning on. And I was also getting into the situations now where I was having to call friends like Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings and try to piece together what I had done the night before and who I might owe some false apology to. And my life was really starting to become unmanageable. But one of the things I did do back then was I worked really, really hard. And I thought if I worked hard, that gave me and defended my right to drink. So I would actually show up at work, you know, before the time I was supposed to. I'd put in a full day. I was the kind of guy that if there was a problem you couldn't handle, give it to me because I was like a little pit bull with it. And you know, that was just my alcoholism. I wouldn't give up on anything. So they kind of loved that work attitude. And what happened after a few years of working there, this job opened up in Boston. And they asked me if I wanted this job. And I couldn't say yes quick enough. I wanted out of New York because by now New York was the problem. And I ended up packing up my European luggage. And for those of you that don't know what European luggage is, that's basically just hefty bags. So I packed up my hefty bags full of clothes and off I went up to Boston. And when I was up there, I got to take a good look at my drinking because now I had no friends around. And I ended up, I was renting this room with these two other girls that lived in the house. And I thought maybe a little threes company kind of deal. You know, I'd calm down. I wouldn't want to embarrass myself in front of these two girls. And I couldn't have been any more wrong. You know, I would go to work and I'd put in my day there. And on my way home, I would pick up a bottle of vodka. And I remember I'd walk into the house with this bottle of vodka. And I'd take off that cap and I would throw it away because I knew I was never going to need that cap again. And I would sit there drinking that vodka in my room watching a movie or something. And another thing I used to like to do is sometimes I would come home with the vodka and I'd come home with some ice cream. And I would get myself a bowl of ice cream and I would pour that vodka all over the ice cream. And I would make these vodka sundaes. And I would sit there in my room and I would have like one hand over one of my eyes trying to focus in on the TV, and the whole time I'm wondering if Brother Gilbert is right or not. Like, is this it? Am I finally going to lose my sight? And I would sit there having these vodka sundaes and thinking, wow, this is the best of both worlds. I'm eating ice cream and I'm getting drunk at the same time. This is sweet. And this went on a few months living with those girls. And, you know, they often looked in horror at me. You know, I would end up you know, in their bushes outside while washing my car, and you know, they couldn't figure out why. You'd see empty plastic cup there, but I used to fill that up with like 32 ounces of vodka and a few ice cubes and wash my car and just like pass out in the middle of it. And I think they were quite happy when I left, but I finally got this place on my own, and I was all excited. I had my nice apartment up in Boston, and I wasn't there a week before I had my last drink. And I really want to share this last drink with you. It was Labor Day weekend, and I don't know about you guys, but like 3-day weekends used to just petrify me. 2-day weekends was scary enough. When you added on another day, it was like really a horror. And then when you added on like Thanksgiving or something, it was like, oh my God, you might as well just like lock me up. But it was a 3-day weekend, and I didn't get into any trouble. None whatsoever. I just spent the 3 days what I would call relaxing. But what it was I was just drinking myself into this drunken stupor. And the last thing I remember was watching the Jerry Lewis telethon. And I'm on the couch drinking, watching the Jerry Lewis telethon. And I could not figure out for the life of me why these people with muscular dystrophy were smiling and happy. I couldn't figure it out. And here I am with a great job, a good little car that starts 9 out of 10 times, a great apartment, some money in the bank, and I was just miserable. I was just so empty and so hollow inside. And I don't quite know what had become of me. I was basically this good little kid, and all I wanted to do was have some fun. That was my first drink. And this is where it had taken me now, where I'm just isolated, held up in my apartment for days and just drinking and not wanting to know from anything. And I was getting into the stage now where I would black out 6-7 times on a weekend. I would actually, believe it or not, I would actually set my alarm clock. If I went to bed at like 4, I would set my alarm clock at 7 so I could be in like another blackout by 10. I wanted nothing to do with reality. So as I'm watching this telethon, I pass out. And I came to the next day, and I went into work. And that evening, I got home. And I remember I was cleaning up everything from vodka bottles to beer bottles to wine coolers to wine. And I would have to drink all those different things because I never knew what my stomach was going to be able to hold down. I knew I had to drink, but I just wouldn't know what I wouldn't throw up, you know. And I cleaned up everything, and I went to bed that night, and I didn't sleep at all. All I did was just lie there and sweat. And I did that for the next 3 nights. I didn't sleep at all, and I would just lie in my bed, and I would just sit there shaking and trembling and sweating out this alcohol. And something deep inside had shifted. I knew I didn't want to take a drink, and I knew a drink would fix all this. But I was just done. I was just done. And I remember 2 weeks had passed, and I was starting to get a little shaky, feeling like, you know, I might take a drink. And I remember everyone left the office, and I pulled out the phone book, and I saw St. Elizabeth's Hospital. I knew where that was. And they had this outpatient alcohol program. So I decided to call them up. And I remember as I'm calling them up, I'm debating to myself, okay, is this really what you want to do? Because I'm questioning, has alcohol maybe been the glue that's been holding everything together for you? You know, and as I'm making the call, like it talks in the big book, you know, I couldn't picture my life if I kept on drinking, and I couldn't picture my life without alcohol. I could not picture it either way. And just as I'm having these thoughts go through my mind, someone picks up the phone. I told them who I was, and I told them I saw they had an outpatient program, and I was wondering if I can go to their alcohol abuse outpatient program. And I remember I told the lady, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. I still wasn't quite sure. Despite all the evidence, I wasn't quite sure. So the woman told me, yeah, we can get you in, but it's going to be 2 weeks. And I said, fine. And I remember that little bit of action I took gave me enough hope to make it another 2 weeks. Like I felt like I was going to be doing something. I didn't know what the answer was, but I just felt like I was going to be doing something. And 2 weeks came and went. I remember I made my appointment, and I went into this woman's office, and she started asking me the regular questions. You know, what's your name, and where do you live, and of course, you know, what kind of insurance do you have? And this woman asked me the most important question anybody had ever asked me up to this point in my life. This woman looked at me and she asked, Victor, are you an alcoholic? And I remember just then, like, my vision of an alcoholic, it totally shifted. You know, up to then, I thought it was that guy that lived under a bridge and, you know, would drink himself all day long, or, you know, a guy living in a refrigerator box, or someone homeless in the street. That was always my perception and vision of an alcoholic. But for some reason, it shifted to where maybe an alcoholic is someone that when they start drinking, they just can't stop, no matter how much they want to stop. And I remember I told that lady, I said, yes, I'm an alcoholic. And up to that point, anything anybody else used to tell me was, you know, maybe you drink too much. Or maybe you should curb your drinking. Or why don't you just try drinking on weekends? Or maybe you shouldn't drink, you know, the strong stuff. Just stick with beer. But nobody ever asked me that question. I remember when I had said yes, she looked at me and she smiled. And somehow I got a little bit of hope from that smile. And for some reason, when I said yes to that question, I don't know what it did, but it just really shifted my thinking, like maybe there's hope for all. Maybe this explains all the insanity that I've had in my life. And I started going to this outpatient program, and there they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew nothing about AA. And I started going to AA meetings. Are you yawning, Mike? Am I boring you? And I started going to AA meetings. And if you're new and you're not really quite getting it, let me tell you, I get that. Because I'd go to these meetings and I would hear things like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Thinking, that can't be right. It's got to be like number 7 or number 8 where you really start feeling the buzz. And then I'd hear people talk, yeah, it's a spiritual malady, that's why I drank. And I'm thinking, a spiritual what? And then you'd hear, God either is or he isn't. Or rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. And I would sit there and I would listen to you guys and I'm like, this cannot be the answer. And I would read those steps on the wall. And I would look at the 12 steps and I'm thinking, geez, when I went to Catholic school, they only gave me like 10 steps to follow. You guys are like giving me 2 more that I have to follow. And then I'd hear for newcomers, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I would think to myself, when I went to Catholic school, I would have to go to church once a week. That would be like going to church 90 straight days. Why would I ever want to do that? And then I would read through the steps and I'd get to the 4th and 5th step, something I was never, ever, ever going to do in my life, you know. And I would think to myself, I lied every time I went to confession and spoke to a priest. Why would I ever want to get honest with like a stranger or something? And it wasn't making any sense to me. But it shouldn't have made any sense to me. Because what you guys were offering me was a new way of living that I knew nothing about. Your way of living was totally contradictory to the way I was living. It didn't make any sense to me. And I heard a saying in these rooms, I might not know what you're talking about, but I'll still have an opinion. And I didn't know what you guys were talking about, but my opinion was that these steps were not going to work for me, and this is really great that you guys have this. And my new philosophy was that if I had a little bit of knowledge, which is what I was obtaining going to my outpatient program, backed by willpower, that was all I needed to stay sober. That was it. And I can tell you, I went on for about 10 months like that. And I would go to an AA meeting if there was absolutely nothing to do. Nothing. And even then, sometimes I chose nothing. And after about 10 months, I remember it was July 5th, 1989. And my sobriety date is September 6th, 1988. And I woke up, it was about 4 or 5 in the morning, and I'm sobbing, crying. And I know today is the day that I'm going to kill myself. I am in so much pain from being on this dry drunk that I don't want to feel it anymore. I want to check out. I just couldn't do it. And I was at that crossroads. To be doomed an alcoholic death or to live by a spiritual basis is not always an easy alternative for the alcoholic. And that's what it says in our big book, and that's where I was, right there at that crossroads. And for some reason, I had a little epiphany. You know, one of many that I've had in AA. And I thought to myself, why don't you try AA the way it's laid out? And you can make this killing yourself the B plan. So I started going to lots more meetings. And I had about a year and a half of sobriety up in Boston now. And I got offered a job out in L.A. And if you're living in Boston and someone offers you a job out in L.A., you run out there as fast as you can. Because it gets so cold in Boston. How cold does it get? It gets so cold, you have no idea how many times I saw the neighbor's dog stuck to the fire hydrant. That's cold. So I move out to L.A. And, you know, I realized that I needed you guys, and you guys didn't really need me. And I started going to lots more meetings. And I started going to step meetings. And I started going to big book meetings. And I started to take commitments. But one thing I wouldn't do was ask somebody to be my sponsor. I just wouldn't do it. And once again, it was my pride and ego stepping in. And once again, it was those childhood thoughts I had of, if I got 100% honest with somebody, what were they going to think of me? And I never wanted to be judged. So after living out in L.A. for 2 years, I moved back to the East Coast. And I was living in the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia area. And I had about 4 years of sobriety, and I started going to meetings. And I kept running into this one guy at all the meetings I was going to, Little Mike. And, you know, I started to notice that I really hadn't changed much. You know, all my character defects were still there, and I would hear the same person is going to drink again, and I started to get a little nervous with that because I was starting to believe you guys. And I asked Little Mike if he would be my sponsor. And I remember Little Mike looking up at me, and not too many people do. But he looked at me and he said, you know, I'll be your sponsor, but I want you to know I don't care about your feelings. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm here to help you save your life. And of course, I thought to myself, I evidently asked the wrong person to be my sponsor. He's kind of taking this thing too serious. I wanted, like, the sponsor where I could say you're my sponsor, but I don't really want to do a whole lot, you know? And that wasn't Mike's deal, you know. I would see Mike at our home group meeting on Tuesdays, and he'd always ask me, you know, when are you going to call? When are you going to call? And I would always give him some cheap excuse. And then finally, after a couple of years of seeing him in this meeting and getting to know him a little bit better, I would start calling him. And I learned a lot of things from Mike. And I remember when I started to call him with a little regularity, I would go out and I would destroy everything. I would just, like, make a mess of everything. And I would call him up and I'd say, Mike, hey, this is what I have going on. And the only thing he would say to me is, you're reporting, you're not sharing. Like, okay, but what about this problem I have? I can't help you. And then after a couple of weeks, you know, I'd go to give him another test. And I'd call him after I destroyed everything. And he would tell me the same thing, you're reporting and you're not sharing. Finally, I asked him, I'm like, Mike, what is up with this reporting and not sharing? And he'd tell me, you know, Victor, you go about your business, you're as selfish and self-centered as could be, you make a mess of everything, and then you call me up looking for answers. That's reporting. If you were to share with me and call me regularly and tell me what's going on in your life, maybe you could avoid a lot of those situations you get yourself into. And that would be sharing. I couldn't argue with him. He was right. You know, and then I'd call him up and be like, Mike, I kind of got myself into a little mess today. What do you think I should do? And he would tell me, Victor, you got yourself in that mess because you put yourself in those situations. And again, I couldn't argue with him. You know, and after knowing him for a while, I actually thought I'd be slick and share with him, you know, and I would call him up and I'd share some stuff with him, and he would offer me some suggestions. And after he got done with that, his suggestions, I would say, "Mike, I just don't think I can do that." He would say, "Victor, you can do that. You just don't want to do it." And it was like I could never win with Mike, but I was always wrong. And after about 5 years, I moved out to San Diego, and I had about 10 years of sobriety when I moved out here, and that's when I met my current sponsor. And I found this man that I felt comfortable enough with that I felt like I could finally get 100% honest with. I had this secret, which really wasn't anything too major, but since it was mine, it was major, that I just finally felt like I could unload on somebody. I started working the steps with him, and we got to the fifth step, and I remember, I'm gonna tell my sponsor. And I remember sitting there, we were at a park, and I'm sitting at the bench, and I'm holding my paper, and I'm shaking and trembling, and my voice is quivering, and I, you know, told him what I needed to tell him. And after I got done with that fifth step, he looked at me and he said, "Victor, I want you to know I love you and you're a good man." I'm thinking to myself, maybe he didn't hear me. But he did hear me. And at that moment, I felt freed of everything. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me why I waited so long to do that. And it was my fear. And once again, that, you know, what are you going to think of me if I become 100% honest? And I could see so many times in my sobriety where that kind of thinking really was going to kill me. So that was at about 11 years sobriety. 13 years of sobriety, I got married. This girl I was dating in Virginia moved out with me, and we dated for 7 years. I want to tell you, it took 7 years for that all that fear to finally be replaced with love. But it happened from listening to you guys in these rooms. And then after about 16 years, I started to really get involved in prayer and meditation. You guys would always talk about it, and it's one of our steps. And some outside source told me about prayer and meditation. I'm thinking, wow, it must really be important if someone outside of AA is doing this, you know? And I started doing prayer and meditation. I could tell you that totally provided another shift in my thinking. And I've got a friend that he always mentions the alcoholic, given the choice between freedom and shackles, will always choose shackles. And I used to think about that when he said that, and it finally dawned on me that my shackles have always been my selfishness and self-centeredness. And my selfishness and self-centeredness will always, always, always block the entry of God and make me uncomfortable. And I want to share this one paragraph with you that I always read. I always read to the guys before I go through the steps with them. And it's in the foreword of the 12 and 12. And it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Now, I remember I was reading that to this gentleman that I just started sponsoring, and he looked at me and he was mad. And he asked me, "You really don't believe that, do you?" And I told him I did. And I left it at that. And when we got to the ninth step and I started reading the promises to him out of the big book, he just started crying and sobbing. And it was at that very moment that I realized he experienced the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous that I experienced. And he now was happy, joyous, and free. And, you know, I can tell you, and this is just my belief, but you don't get from where I was to where I am today without some kind of miracle happening in your life. You know, and I honestly believe that there was some act of providence that took place in my life. Because you don't go from drinking and blackout drinking to just stopping. The only explanation I can give is a higher power. You know, and I often wonder, You know, those lessons that I was taught in grammar school, you know, was Brother John right? You know, is God watching over me? And for me, the answer is yes. You know, and that story about the train, you know, where this car came out of nowhere and drove me all the way to my front door. You know, again, those lessons taught in grammar school of, you know, maybe when people die and they do watch over you, you know. And that's a belief that shifted for me instead of everything being just good luck and bad luck. And, you know, I want to tell you, I really truly believe that this program is for anybody. If you're just willing to take action and willing to change some of your old ideas. And I've just seen it work miracles. And I want to close with this last thing that as a result of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I am actually a very rich man today. And someday I'm going to have money also. Thank you for letting me share. Don't drink.